I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The book is called Not My Party, The Rise and Fall of Canadian Tories, from Robert Stanfield to Stephen Harper. Its author is the political scientist, former federal cabinet minister, former member of parliament from Prince Edward Island, and former diplomat Tom McMillan. In the book, he also recounts his own years in politics, first as a policy secretary to Robert Stanfield, then through his years running for the Progressive Conservative Party, his time as a minister in Brian Mulroney's cabinet, through to his defeat in the free trade election of 1988, his subsequent attempts at re-election, as well as his years in Boston, where he resides today, where for a number of years he was Canada's consul general to New England. The book is a lively, fascinating look at the last 50 years plus of politics in Canada, with stories about people in Canada's political past. It also laments the end of the old PC party and its, according to the author, devolution to a party he hasn't been able to support, the Conservative Party that emerged after the merger of the Reform Canadian Alliance Party. The book offers a way for progressives to reclaim their party, and it provides an argument for its place in the Canadian discourse. Tom McMillan was first elected to the House of Commons in 1979, re-elected in 1980 and 1984. In 1984, he was appointed a Minister of State in the Mulroney government, going on to serve as Environment Minister from 1985 to 1988. The book is published by Nimbus. Please welcome to the Plant Online program in Boston today the Honorable Tom McMillan. Mr. McMillan, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
I'm glad to be with you.
So, as I was telling you before we started, it's a great book because there's a lot in here to talk about, and I know that just looking at my sheet of notes here that I made in the course of several sheets of notes that I made in the course of reading your book, there's a lot to cover. There's some marvelous stories and anecdotes, obviously, but was it important for you, Tom, to write about where you see this party, that you know and have served and run under over the years? I mean, was it important for you to write a policy prescription just as it was a memoir, say?
It was more than important to me. It was urgent. I believe a great national institution has been badly sullied by the merger of the Progressive Conservative Party of Canada, as it was then, with the Reform Party / Alliance Party in 2003. I can see the reasons for that merger, the rationale being that people right of center, perhaps, believed that unless conservative parties, of which there were two main ones, were united, then the Liberals in particular would have control of the government of Canada and of the national agenda forever and a day, divide and rule kind of thing. But while understanding that rationale, I very much regret the way things have turned out. The Progressive name was dropped, and with the dropping of that name, the Progressive tradition of the party, a belief in activist government for the public good, was eliminated in favor of an ideological agenda that was totally foreign to the Canadian tradition of conservatism, which was progressive, reformist, modern, people-focused, and was committed to an agenda of initially building the country and then developing it through the state in concert with the private sector and with Canadians. And that very progressive tradition, which was both federal and provincial, over many generations, over many administrations, over many politicians' careers, that was just thrown out the window to form or reform the Conservative Party into a neo-con Republican Party style party that was very, very different from the historic party of old. And I am so upset and and preoccupied with the demise of that great distinguished institution that I felt an urgency to write a book and tell why I think the party should start anew and use the opportunity of Stephen Harper's retirement as leader and the pending leadership convention to find a replacement to rethink its historic roots and restore its progressive traditions.
Right. So what did Red Tories do in the so-called Red Tories? Over the last decade or so that Mr. Harper was in office. I mean, did folks like yourself? Did you vote for another party, say, or?
Well, in the extreme case, Joe Clark, following the 2003 merger. After all, he had been a Conservative Prime Minister, mm-hmm. and party leader in opposition. Urged the Canadian public to support Paul Martin instead of the reconstituted Conservative Party because he quite rightly, now set aside whether that particular course he took mm-hmm. was wise, appreciated that the new party was nothing like the old. And the agenda that it was pursuing and ultimately foisted on the country was so different from what Tories have traditionally believed in and executed when in government, that to him, he wasn't abandoning his party. To his mind, the party abandoned him, and I feel very much the same way. Now some Tories of this persuasion joined with Stephen Harper and that crowd and tried to make it work. Others abandoned the party altogether. Still others hoped that over time the party would come to its senses, or what survived of it in the new merger, and something could be restored. In my own case, I had accepted a diplomatic post in Boston as Consul General, and I had eventually gravitated to the university sector as a teacher and uh-huh. and writer, and I pretty well didn't so much lose interest in the party as lose a passion for it. Mm. And I saw the retirement of Stephen Harper from politics as an opportunity for the party to rethink what it had done in 2003, restore its progressive name, restore its progressive tradition. And I have no interest, I'm well past that point, of ever getting involved in politics again, either as a candidate or as an active organizer. I mean, I've paid my dues to the public and to the party in that respect. But I believe so fervently in the great historic cause of the traditional Conservative Party, and I'm so chagrined by what became of it that I felt, well, I could make one last contribution to a party that I had devoted my career and most of my life to by laying out a case for proceeding in that direction.
And you make that case in the last third of the book, but the two thirds previous to that, you recount your life and your start in politics, and I found the stories that you provide, the anecdotes, quite fascinating throughout. Let's run through the life before we get into your political career. You were born where? On Prince Edward Island?
I was born in Charlottetown. Mm-hmm. I'm a twin. My fraternal twin Charlie became Brian Mulroney's intellectual bodyguard, as he was often described, both in opposition and later in government. I was educated in primary school and high school, and my first university degree in Prince Edward Island, in the last case at what is now the University of Prince Edward Island, which then was called St. Dunstan's, and later did my graduate work at Queen's. I became, after I finished my graduate work in politics, political studies at Queen's, Robert Stanfield's principal policy secretary, well, only policy secretary,
right.
The principal functionary, research and drafter for Robert Stanfield's, what I call the extra-parliamentary policy process that he devised, a very elaborate policy development process in concert with the founding president of Trent University. So my early years in politics were very much those of a party functionary,
yeah,
in the policy area. And then, of course, I eventually gravitated to electoral politics and got myself elected as a member of parliament in Prince Edward Island, and eventually was appointed to the Mulroney cabinet.
Yeah. So the we'll talk about Mr. Stanfield because he's a fascinating figure in of himself. But I guess one of the first people you meet as a kid is Louis Saint Laurent, and you liked him, didn't you?
I did. I was in grade six. I was only about I was preteen, 10 years old or something like that. I was in grade six. I wasn't quite a teen, I was a student at Queen Square School, which is long since gone, in downtown Charlottetown. I was walking home, and right across the street from Queen Square School is Province House, which is arguably the most historic building in Canada. That's where the Fathers of Confederation met in 1864 in Charlottetown to give birth to Canada. And it was at the tail end of the 1957 federal general election. Louis Saint Laurent, the then Prime Minister, Liberal Prime Minister, was campaigning, and at a time when this couldn't possibly happen today, he was alone without security guards or even assistance. He was just there staring at the exterior of Province House, and I didn't recognize him as the Prime Minister of Canada. I did recognize him as from away and not a local. He didn't look like anybody I'd ever met before,
uh-huh,
in person. And I asked him whether I could help him. I thought maybe he was lost or needed directions. And he declined my offer, but asked me who I was, and then asked me whether I knew who he was. And I had to admit that I didn't. And he said, "Well, Tommy," as I called myself then, and my friends still do, my close friends do, he said, "Tommy, do you know who," after admitting that I didn't know who he was, he said, "Well, I am Louis Saint Laurent, Prime Minister of Canada." And I recount in the prologue of my book that the next thing he said, which stuck to me to this very day, he said, "Son, no matter what happens to me in a few days, and in a few days' time, the election was to be held, mm-hmm, I want you to know that when you met me, I was Prime Minister of Canada." And it was very clear to me, even though I was just a schoolboy, that there was a fatalism in the way he said it, as though he knew he was not going to win the election. I was knowledgeable enough about politics through my father, who was very active in Tory parties at the time, to know that the election was underway,
uh-huh,
and that it would be held in a few days' time. And when he said that, I said to myself all the way home, "Boy, this guy, he doesn't think he's going to win this election."
Yeah.
And he wanted this little schoolboy in Charlottetown to know that that when he met the Prime Minister, that older gentleman was, in fact,
yeah,
the Prime Minister of Canada. And I recall that story in my book and say that that incident sparked my passion for politics and initially my the discovery of my inner liberal.
Yeah.
And this was at a politics was taken very, very seriously in Prince Edward Island, just like religion, as to some extent it still is. And my parents had a Tory heritage going way back to Charlemagne, practically, and they were appalled that I was so enthusiastic about having met the Liberal Prime Minister of Canada, to the extent that I was, at that very young age, prepared to declare myself a Liberal.
And so that the 57 election was the one that Mr. Diefenbaker won, and then he wins the big one, I guess, a year later. You met Mr. Diefenbaker when, for the first time?
Well, it's interesting. I just had to finish the other story. Yeah. I mean, everybody thought that Louis Saint-Laurent would be reelected. All the public opinion polls showed that the Liberals were leading the Tories, and Maclean's magazine actually went to print with a cover story assuming that the Grits would win.
polls got it wrong back then, eh?
Yeah, exactly. But I was convinced that Louis Saint-Laurent would lose because he told me, in effect, that he thought he would. I met John Diefenbaker. I met him a number of times in Prince Edward Island in various electoral forays. I attended big public meetings, and on one or two occasions actually rubbed shoulders with him, as thousands of others did on the island. My first real brush with him, if I could put it that way, was when I was doing my master's thesis in politics at Queen's. And my Tory member of parliament back in Charlottetown, as it turned out, was my predecessor, became my predecessor in that same riding, arranged for me to interview John George Diefenbaker in his center block office on Parliament Hill for my MA thesis, which was the 1956 Tory leadership convention at which John Diefenbaker became leader. So I spent an hour with him. I brought along my twin brother Charlie for reasons that are probably a little too complicated to get into. The two of us went, and I interviewed John Diefenbaker for about an hour. Found him fascinating, charismatic, and imposing, and of course, eloquent, and all those sorts of things. But I found him a very strange man, and as it turned out, almost everything he said in response to my various questions on the subject of my master's thesis, I had to discount because he simply imposed on my topic all kinds of biases and prejudices and hatreds and resentments and vendettas that predated me and even predated the 1956 leadership convention, which is the subject of my thesis. Every time I raised a subject, it is though it had nothing to do with my thesis at all. It was an opportunity for him to vent all the frustrations that by that time, this was in 1969, he would have had, and this was 2 years after he had lost the leadership, so he was still very bitter. In fact, he went to his grave as a bitter old man.
Yeah. What, I guess you had run in 79 for the first time, is that right? And then he ran also in that election, did he not?
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
Well, he died in...
I guess after the election.
August. I think he died in August of 1979, didn't he?
Yeah, but after the election, before the House sat, I guess.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, that's right. I was elected for the first time in what was called Hillsborough then, is now called Charlottetown, in May of 1979. So technically, we didn't actually sit together in Parliament.
Yeah. You spent these years with Mr. Stanfield working for him in terms of policy. Did he ever give you, Robert Stanfield, in any sense about how he felt about Diefenbaker?
He did. He was a great loyalist long after most other Tories abandoned him, whether they were party leaders or premiers or just rank-and-file members. He remained very loyal, which was his nature in any event, to Diefenbaker. And certainly when he was elected Premier of Nova Scotia in the mid-50s, just before Diefenbaker became elected Prime Minister, he was very loyal. And by the end of Diefenbaker's Prime Ministership in 1953, he was practically the only major Tory in the country, certainly among the premiers, who was in fact loyal to Diefenbaker. He certainly recognized the man's limitations,
mm-hmm.
and he didn't agree at all with most of the things that Diefenbaker stood for towards the end. You recall that Diefenbaker was anti-bilingualism. He fought tooth and nail the Liberal government's legislation for official languages, and Diefenbaker fought Pearson's efforts to have for Canada a distinct flag and all those kinds of things. So the loyalty that Stanfield had for Diefenbaker was not on policy,
yeah.
least of all in those various areas. It was more just the decency of the man.
Yeah.
And I think it was in the nature of the Stanfields as a family to be loyal and to be supportive of friends and colleagues and associates. And he never would be critical of anyone, even those whom he didn't particularly respect, except in very moderate and muted tones. But the short answer is that he admired John Diefenbaker. He just didn't think he was the kind of Tory leader suitable for the time.
Yeah.
And that's why when he became leader himself, Robert Stanfield, in September of 1967, he became a very different leader from that which John Diefenbaker had been, much more progressive, much more policy-oriented. He believed in evidence and facts and rational discussion and consensus-building, teamwork,
yeah.
and the application of collective wisdom, whereas Diefenbaker had no use for policy at all. Policy, Peter Newman, the great writer and one-time editor of Maclean's magazine,
mm-hmm.
Described John Diefenbaker's attitude towards policy, either party policy or government policy, for that matter, as merely a sub-branch of rhetoric. Diefenbaker was the master of sloganeering, of polemics, and frankly, of demagoguery, and of the art of the bumper sticker politics. If it can't be said in half a dozen words, then it ain't good policy kind of thing.
Yeah.
Robert Stanfield was a true intellectual. He was a very thoughtful man. He believed in evidence-based policy and in facts and objectivity,
yeah.
and had neither a flair for nor a particular interest in sloganeering and high rhetoric.
Now, you work in... by the way, as I'm reading your book and you're writing about Mr. Stanfield, he's a significant figure not only in conservative politics, but in the country itself. And I guess I'm reading your book and I'm lamenting that no one has taken him on as a subject for a full-length biography.
You're absolutely right. Jeffrey Stevens wrote a quite good book, but it wasn't very... very large, which brought the subject up to 1972,
yeah.
and the election of that year, but it didn't deal with the two most important years in many ways of Stanfield's public career. That was between 72 and 76 when he retired,
yeah.
as leader, during which time he almost became prime minister. And made his most significant impact both on the Conservative Party and on the country as a whole. And I will say this without fear of contradiction, as a Maritimer myself, Robert Stanfield was the most outstanding public figure to emerge from Atlantic Canada in the second half of the 20th century.
Hmm.
So I agree with you. It's puzzling that a full biography of this man's public career has yet to be written, and as I point out in the introduction of my own book, my book is not intended as that comprehensive biography, it deals with a broader subject, the Conservative Party writ large, if you will. But I think it does help to fill a lot of the void as far as Robert Stanfield is concerned. There are many pages and many passages devoted to the contribution that he made to the Conservative Party and to public life, and the lasting impression and the lasting impact he had on the country, both through the policies that he advanced, many of which were accepted by the Liberal government, and the overall standard that he set for the political class in Canada. I think he was practically without equal as a public figure who could serve as a model forever and a day for everyone who goes into public life as far as personal integrity and public virtue are concerned.
Yeah. And so how long did you work for Mr. Stanfield?
I joined his staff in, before going full-time, I worked the summer of 69 on a major policy conference, which really it was a baptism of fire for me, that the Conservative Party was having on policy under Robert Stanfield and the direction of Tom Simons, then president of Trent University. And I was a graduate student at Queen's when I started with Stanfield to work on that policy conference. And soon thereafter, really the winter of 69-70, I began in earnest, and by the summer of 70, I was a full-time policy secretary for Robert Stanfield and the Progressive Conservative Party, which is by way of saying that I was the principal writer and researcher for the extra-parliamentary policy process that was instituted by Stanfield and Tom Simons, again, then president of Trent University, to involve the broad membership of the party in thinking about policy and developing policy for both the parliamentary caucus and more particularly for the party at large in elections. So there was a bureaucracy, a research bureaucracy for the party, the research office, the policy research office, and that's a separate thing altogether. But as far as the involvement of the broad membership of the party in policy was concerned, I was Stanfield's principal policy secretary, and I remained so until he departed the leadership in 1976. But to be honest, after he failed to follow up on his near win in 1972 and lost the election, the wage and price controls election of 1974, and then announced thereafter his intention to retire, by 74, at my job, as was the case with Tom Simons, with whom I worked very closely, was pretty much over. Yeah. So, technically, from 1969 to 1976, but effectively 1970 to about 1974. And then, soon thereafter, I got involved in politics myself as a member of Parliament.
Yeah, and so you were elected to the House, as we said earlier, in 1979, and that's the year that Joe Clark won a minority government. What went wrong there?
Well, I deal with that in the book and at length, and I think probably more candidly than is in my best interest in terms of my longevity on this planet. I think it was a combination of the Joe Clark being almost too young when he became leader. He was only 37, and he was still in his 30s, not quite 40 when he became prime minister. I think he was no match for Trudeau and Keith Davey, this Senator Davey who ran Trudeau's campaign in 74. And these people, as a strategist and as a tactician, I think some very bad judgments were made by not just Joe Clark, but others, especially his Praetorian Guard. There were certain assumptions made that were false, and should have been seen to have been false at the time. the principal one of which was that the government, the new Clark government, had a mandate to act as though it was a majority, but it was not. Mm. It was a strong minority, and it should have been cautious. It should have been conciliatory. It should have planned for the long term and taken one step at a time. Instead, it just jumped into a very activist agenda, which included the celebrated and subsequently fatal 18 cent a gallon excise tax on gasoline, a budget, John Crosby's budget, which was very austere. No doubt the country's finances were in terrible shape,
mm-hmm.
and there was a case to be made for whipping those finances into shape. But I think the government was tried to do too much too quickly, and didn't sufficiently appreciate the precarious parliamentary situation it was in, and how necessary it was to tiptoe. As it progressed, and
mm-hmm.
you know, for lack of better judgment and political smarts and strategic and tactical finesse, the Liberals just outsmarted Clark, and the rest is history.
Yeah.
The government was defeated, and was elected in May. By December, it was defeated.
Yeah,
on the floor of the House of Commons,
yeah,
in a vote that, by the way, could have been avoided. Because we control the agenda. But in their arrogance and, frankly, stupidity and incompetence, they thought that... I think they appreciated that the government was going to be defeated, but I think they also believed that the Liberals would pay a price for having defeated the government after such a short time, and they were just simply wrong.
Yeah, and Mr. Trudeau comes back in February... and then wins, and then he's there till 84. At that point, Trudeau resigns. You have John Turner as the leader of the Liberal Party. He's prime minister for a spell, and over at your party, the Progressive Conservative Party, Mr. Mulroney's a leader. He becomes prime minister, and then you enter cabinet, I guess, as a junior secretary. Is that right?
Well, just before that, when Brian Mulroney took over the leadership from Joe Clark in June
mm-hmm.
of 1983. This was just a few months before the election of 1884, which was in September. I served with Brian Mulroney as his deputy House leader, responsible for question period,
mm-hmm.
and I was the person whose task it was to orchestrate our strategy in Parliament in the most important of all forms, which was question period. And then when the Mulroney government was elected in September of 1984, I was appointed as Minister of State for Tourism, which is a very minor portfolio. I think it was created, as I say pretty frankly in the book, to ensure cabinet representation for Prince Edward Island at a time when every province... they pretty well expected to be given such,
mm-hmm.
but to the surprise of a lot of people, not least the Prime Minister, I turned that junior ministry into something to be reckoned with. I was able to reform Canada's marketing to the world and other things, and was getting attention in the media and to some extent, to less extent, in Parliament. And then when the Minister of the Environment, Mulroney's first Minister of the Environment, Suzanne Blake Grenier, made such a hash of that portfolio, within a year, less than a year, the Prime Minister fired her and asked me if I would take over that portfolio at a time when the environment was major.
Mm-hmm.
It was controversial. It was at the center of the government's agenda. And of the public's attention. And many of the burning issues of the day, for example, acid rain, were at the top of the government's agenda and the public's consciousness. And even some other issues like free trade had
mm-hmm.
a very strong environmental dimension. So I was thrust into the eye of the storm as Minister of the Environment, and I served as the longest-serving Minister of the Environment in Canada history, except for John Roberts, the Liberal, who tied, whose record I tied in, mm-hmm. in that connection. So I served almost all of the first term of Brian Mulroney as his Minister of the Environment, and it was really during that period that most of the government's major accomplishments in the environmental field, which have not been equaled since and certainly weren't equaled before, were forged. I was defeated in the free trade election of 1988, which swept almost every Tory into the ocean in uh-huh. Atlantic Canada, even though we won it nationally.
Yeah.
And thereafter, I was appointed Consul General to Boston, well, Canada's Consul General to New England in Boston. But yeah. in the meantime, I was front and center in many of the major policy initiatives of the government the first term of Mulroney in office.
Yeah, and you and I agree, as you write in the book, that his memoir is a heck of a good read. Well, what were the qualities of Brian Mulroney that you admire still, and in terms of leadership and even his how he is privately with people? I mean, there's a lot to be admired there, isn't there?
There is. He's very different in private from his public image. I think his adversaries and detractors succeeded over time in painting him as arrogant and sort of an arrivist and nouveau riche and too big for his britches and all that kind of stuff. When they didn't emphasize the Irish charm and the baloney as they would see it. I saw him close up, and I got to know him a lot better than I might otherwise have done because my brother was such an intimate of his, and for a long time, well before he became Prime Minister, and then throughout the time he was Prime Minister. And I found him very focused, very goal-oriented, a very rational man, a person who placed a very high premium on preparedness. And while all the Irish charm and gregariousness and those qualities that are associated with him are true, when you're dealing with him, in my case, as a cabinet minister and as a political colleague, you don't see much of that. He doesn't waste a lot of time, or didn't, on pleasantries. He was pleasant, but he was very down to earth. If you met with him, for example, in my case, initially to be appointed to the cabinet and later to be shuffled and promoted within cabinet, focus was all. The pleasantries were perfunctory and very short, if they existed at all. He just got right down to business. He was one of the most focused and disciplined operators I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And as a government leader, he ran a very tight ship and had a very low tolerance for buffoonery or a waste of time or unnecessary, for the lack of a better way of putting it, gregariousness. Those were sort of public qualities and private virtues, too. The fact is, though, he was very much a business-like sort. And in that respect, he shared a fundamental trait with Robert Stanfield. They're both disciplined and focused and smart and all, you know, goal-oriented and all that. But whereas Mulroney relied heavily on personal relations, consulting a broad network of people that he built up over the years, and relied very heavily on his own instincts based on such personal relations and consultations. Stanfield was more deliberative in the sense that he relied heavily on synthesizing the views of others rather than going on his own instincts.
Yeah.
Now, I know the difference may seem subtle, but Stanfield created an elaborate policy process within the party to involve hundreds, indeed thousands of people, including experts and specialists outside the party, whom he involved in this process and consulted. He was more deliberative and more process-oriented, whereas Mulroney, you know, he respected the party, and I guess he did involve the party to some extent, but he was more like Lyndon Baines Johnson, strangely enough.
Mm-hmm.
He was a glad-hander. He was a backslapper. He was somebody who believed in personal relations and building a personal network and relying heavily on those kinds of relationships which he built over time, and then at the end of the day went with his own instincts.
Yeah.
And he was more instinctual as a politician, whereas I would say Robert Stanfield was more intellectual, not smarter necessarily,
mm-hmm.
but more intellectual and more philosophical and more Socratic, in the sense that he did believe in process. He did believe in collective decision-making and consensus building and team play and all those sorts of things. So these were two very different men.
Yeah.
I mean, Robert Stanfield was an aristocrat. He was the grandson of Charles Stanfield, who founded the Stanfield Underwear Empire. And Americans would call such a blue blood a Brahmin. So we... You know, he was a very progressive, some would say socialist, I wouldn't,
mm-hmm.
but some would, aristocrat, with, you know, pedigree going way back. Whereas Mulroney was the son of a working man, an electrician. He was a plebeian, an overachiever, if you will. He was smart, but these were two different kinds of men. And as a result, their leadership styles, their respective leadership styles, were very different.
Yeah. What? Back to where we started the conversation in terms of where this party of yours has gone. You know, you lament the fact that the reform element came into it, and Mr. Harper did what he did over the last 9 years or 10 years now, I guess. Couldn't you have foreseen, those of you in the old Progressive Conservative Party and Mr. Mulroney's government, how the West felt disconnected to your party, and that's why reform and came up?
Well, I think you're right there to some extent. The fact is, though, the Conservative Party is the oldest national, in quotation marks, party in the country. After all, it was created in 1854, before Canada itself was founded. It was a coalition of different factions, if you will, liberal, conservative, West, East, French, English. So it was a pan-Canadian coalition that founded the country, gave birth to it, and created many of the instruments that made Canada possible: the Canadian Pacific Railway, the National Railway, the Canadian Wheat Board, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. So it really did believe from its earliest days in activist government, fiscally disciplined government, and a government restrained by all the facets of the political culture, the media and the ballot box and all mm-hmm. those sorts of things. But nevertheless, in activist government, and that was true right through the history of the party until 2003, whether it was R.B. Bennett during the Depression or Arthur Meehan, who created the Canadian National Railway, and John Diefenbaker with his Roads to Resources and the foundations of Medicare. Pearson created Medicare, but John Diefenbaker laid the groundwork right through to Brian Mulroney.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Sir John A. Macdonald created the National Park System, which was unheard of when it was done in the mid-1800s. So, I mean, there was this tradition of believing in government and thinking that government was not just an essential, but also fundamentally a good thing necessary to harness the resources of the country. And then this crowd that hijacked the Conservative Party, the grand old institution I've just described, was from a different philosophical tradition altogether, one that was much more American, more libertarian. We say neoconservative, although mm-hmm. the political scientists prefer the term neoclassical, which believes that government is a threat to personal liberty. The emphasis is on the individual and individual freedom, and the public interest is less important than the private interest and individual rights and property rights and all those sorts of things. So there are very different traditions. Stephen Harper came from this, what I would call American tradition, or libertarian tradition, and a long succession of Tory leaders, beginning with Sir John A. Macdonald right through to Brian Mulroney, belonged to what is often called a communitarian tradition, a community-oriented tradition, one that believes that society is more than the sum of its parts, however important the parts might be, that the public interest has to be considered paramount when there's a conflict between the public and the private interest. And what Harper and his ilk did was hijack the grand old Tory party and hive off its progressive name and with it its progressive heritage, appropriate the name conservative, what was left of the dual name, and then remake it into something it had never been before, which was an American-style, Republican-type political party with its emphasis on individual rights and privacy and hostility to government, a commitment to making government smaller, a philosophical orientation that more or less told the public, well, you're kind of on your own, whereas the philosophical orientation of the traditional party has been one, well, the government has a role to help you.
Yeah. So
we don't want to take over your life. Mm-hmm. We don't want to dictate your life, but we want to do all we can with the instruments of the state to make your life better in concert with you and in partnership. And those are two different traditions.
Yeah.
And now we see in the United States where this leads. It leads to cutting taxes for the rich, removing restraints on corporations, gutting public programs, undermining the social safety net, all in the name of private enterprise and supposedly helping the job creators. But, you know, really what it does, it simply solidifies the power and might and purse of the wealthy at the expense of the broad membership of the community.
Yeah.
And you know, I don't overstate the case when I say that what Stephen Harper did with his minions and fellow fellers is hijack a great national institution with one philosophical heritage and tradition and impose on it a completely different one that is not rooted in Canadian soil, let alone in the history of the grand old Conservative Party.
And so in this new leadership race that the Conservative Party is undergoing at the moment, do you see any hope in terms of a candidate that might bring you home and that your three daughters could vote for, say?
Well, you mentioned my three daughters with good reason. They are 32, 30, 31, 27, 28. And even though they have a very rich Tory heritage going way, way back, not one of them has voted conservative since the 2003 merger because they just don't see in that party the historic family tradition, let alone the country's Tory tradition. I believe strongly in the pivotal role of leadership. You know, policy is important, candidate recruitment is important, fundraising, all those sorts of things. But in our system, party leadership is central, and all those things emanate from it. The party leader symbolizes the party membership. It's, he or she symbolizes what the party stands for. So you have to begin, if you're going to restore the true North Star of the Conservative Party, as I would like to call it, the Progressive Conservative Party, you're going to have to begin with leadership, and the party is afforded that opportunity in a few months when it chooses Stephen Harper's replacement. And I think it'll be awfully important if the reformist, progressive, people-centered tradition of the party, if that is to be restored, then the party is going to have to, A, recognize the importance of heading in that direction, restoring its soul, and B, choosing someone, a man or a woman, who can affect it, who can make it happen. And then the progressives of this type, throughout the broad membership, are going to have to be very smart. They're just going to have to outsmart those who want to be wedded to the status quo. The Harper-type conservatives who remain in the party and who continue to dominate its affairs will not give up the battle easily. They are ideologues. They are zealots. Many of them are motivated by religious-type values. They're absolutists, and they believe that the Conservative Party is the vehicle for the kind of agenda that they want to impose on the country. And they'll not give up the control of the Conservative Party easily. So progressives are going to have to be motivated, believe that the cause is worthwhile, link arms with one another, be shrewd and smart and strategic, and just out-hustle those who are custodians of the status quo. And I believe that can be done. I think enough of them are there. They might be underground. They might have been discouraged mm-hmm. by the strong control that Harper wielded over the party and the country. But I think, I don't think the Progressive Conservative Party of old is dead. I think it's been hibernating, and now the big bear just has to be aroused from hibernation and made to roar again.
Tom, it's been a pleasure talking to you today. This is an engaging book, and I congratulate you on it, and good luck with it.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed our chat.
The same. The book is called Not My Party, The Rise and Fall of Canadian Tories from Robert Stanfield to Stephen Harper. It's from Nimbus Publishing. Its author, the Honorable Tom McMillan, joined me on the line from Boston and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.